I can honestly say that the film we are discussing today was one of the most disturbing films I've seen in a long time. And this isn't even the disturbing movie episode. This is, in fact, the ecological horror, The Bay. I'm your host, Wes Young, and you are listening to, in my own words, the Final Word Media. Let's get season two started.
Did you say something bad?
Yes, ma'am. Something really bad happened. God, she's bleeding.
Where is she bleeding from?
Good morning, Marilyn. I am in Claridge, the host of our annual July 4th party.
Oh my God!
This is the CDC.
Something wrong with the water.
This stuff has chemical steroid in it.
Hey, we got a situation over the 911 call center, and the system's about to go down. We're just overloaded with calls.
Stephanie, you're not answering your phone. I do not want you to get off that boat.
I'm just trying to figure out what's going on. I know they shut down all the roads going into Claridge. Now I'm flying over the water here, and, well, there's just dead fish everywhere.
That's so big.
Welcome to In My Own Words. We made it. It's season two. We survived 2020. Well, so far at least, we have a couple more months left. I'm hoping we can make it all the way through without any killer hornets, killer germs, killer fires. You know, maybe, just maybe, we can make it 1 week without a natural disaster. Now, this podcast is growing in popularity even since I haven't been behind this glorious recording booth. And since I know many of you here are listening for the first time today, here at IMO, I review various types of media, film, TV, internet, and everything in between. All of this and so much more is delivered to you in my own words. Now, a quick programming note before we get into probably one of my favorite films this year. It's going to go lower in the rankings after I see Tenet. I love Christopher Nolan, but for now, we're talking about The Bay. Now, before we get into The Bay, I want to have a quick family chat about the status of In My Own Words. Just a programming note so that you're not shocked when you see, well, the future play out. In season one, I generally would discuss two major topics and compare and contrast the two at the end of the episode. That is no longer possible. Not for any major reason, mainly just for time. You see, when discussing two topics equally, you are dividing your time between two things instead of diving into one subject and touching on another one at the end, which is how I am going to be setting up every episode this season and hopefully for many seasons yet to come. Now, with that out of the way, let's talk about the real reason you're here. The Bay, directed by Barry Levinson and written by Michael Wallach, is a documentary-styled horror film blending the lines of reality. In fact, this movie began as a documentary about the pollution in the Chesapeake Bay. Now, Barry discovered, after preparing most of his research, that this film had already been made. So, using the research he had gathered, he decided to go in another direction. He was discussing one day with his friend Michael Wallach about how Pompeii couldn't really happen nowadays. And they came up with a story, a short story at the time, of a young couple arriving in a town for celebration, discovering everybody dead. And through looking at news footage, security cameras, and even the people's cell phones, they could piece together what happened. Out of that idea, The Bay was born. A quick programming note about The Bay was that Barry decided it would be more powerful if the actors recorded themselves, either on cell phone footage or through webcam footage, news-style journalists reporting in the field sort of filming. Well, it paid off because a significant portion of the movie was actually filmed by the actors themselves, and it cut costs significantly. And that's something interesting about The Bay. When you watch it, you can tell it's very much a low-budget film. However, it still disturbed me incredibly well because of its utter realism. Now, the plot itself, and we'll get into it, is very absurd. And towards the end of the film, that does come across and it gets a little schlocky, but really the beginning is where this film shines. For I'd say the first three-fourths of the film, it is excellent. And I can mainly say that, well, you'll see when we get there. I want to slow roll you a little bit because this film is fantastic. The main events of the film follow the July 4th celebration of the Bayside town of Claridge, Maryland. What becomes apparent soon after the film opens is that something tragic took place on July 4th, 2009. It is also made apparent very early by our lead narrator that many powerful people don't want this information getting out. Again, I want to reiterate that this is by far one of the most disturbing films I've seen in a very long time. And it has nothing to do with the monsters lurking beneath the surface. And a quick note before we get into the actual subjects of this film, this episode of my podcast will contain unsettling concepts such as pollution, parasites, suicide, a little bit of body horror, violence, and government incompetence. You know, basically every day on the news. But you've been warned if any of those topics are upsetting. Also, before we go any further, major spoiler warning. I don't know if you've been itching to see The Bay, but hey, spoilers ahead. Now let's get into the plot of this film. The plot is unveiled in a somewhat sporadic way because of its documentary style. The first scene that you're given is a shot, an aerial shot of ocean water with dead fish filling the surface. It's a lot of fish. And I'm unsure if some of that footage is real or created in a set. I don't know. It's probably not hard to find a place where something leaked into the water and killed a population of fish. Well, during those opening shots, you're greeted with your main character, Donna Thompson, who at the time of the film was a college-age reporter. This was her first day on the job, and she just wanted to capture some human interest stories at the July 4th celebration of Claridge, Maryland. She is narrating the film, taking place in the future, and we're left in the dark for a while as why she is narrating these events, watching, quote-unquote, watching the film with us and discussing what was going on and her experience during this July 4th celebration. We're left in the dark until the end of the movie. And early on, it mentions that weeks prior to this July 4th celebration, two divers were found, two marine biologists, at the bottom of the bay. We see a shot of their bodies, and they are ravaged. And they obviously do not look like shark bites, though the police and the mayor insist it was a shark bite. We are greeted with recording footage of the police standing around the bodies saying, I've never seen a shark bite like that. They normally don't attack each other or just eat the stomach. And believe me, the bodies are not doing too well. It is an incredibly unpleasant scene. However, it's quickly swept away and the town quickly forgets about those bodies. And if that all sounds familiar to you, that's on purpose. A lot of this movie is very thematically similar to Jaws. That's a good way to put it. There's an even homage to Jaws, a tongue-in-cheek moment when children are screaming in a pool when they see someone affected by our monster, and the camera quickly pans and shows a toy shark bouncing on the surface. And a lot of the themes of Jaws and this movie line up. Mainly, the corrupt mayor, who does not want people to leave the town and stop using the ocean. Now back to the beginning of this film, a lot of the shots after our quick opening and our narrator setting the stage are people playing in the ocean, jumping off their boats, swimming, and it's your typical Bayside July 4th celebration. And they even have a crab eating contest. Very small town sort of thing to do. And that is where things get bad. During the crab eating contest, all of the contestants start throwing up graphically everywhere, and everyone is freaking out. Meanwhile, several people are starting to scream and complain about pain and rashes on their bodies. A lot of people are assuming at first that it's some sort of allergen. Well, at this point, we meet our next major character, Dr. Jack Abrams. He's an ER doctor at Atlantic Hospital in Claridge, Maryland. He takes in 30 patients, and he's noticing these bizarre rashes and lesions on the body and the terrible pain and aches these people are having, and they're throwing up and they're nauseous, and he's very confused because he can't really understand what's going on. He, after getting 30 patients that quickly, informs the CDC about what's going on. The CDC takes note of a couple of the symptoms. However, when he mentions that the rashes are spreading and they're not responding to certain treatments, there's a lot of whispering around the CDC office, and this is where a major part of the movie starts to take hold. You witness, through just webcam footage, the wheels of the government system start to roll. Now, this movie is not an anti-government system. In fact, there are very few characters in the movie that are black and white bad. Most people genuinely want to help. The main issue with this film is that even if they want to help, they can't. They're powerless to do so, partly because of the way the system is, and partly because they can't really stop what's coming for them, which we will get to. Keep that pin up there. We'll get to what it is. Well, during all of this, we're greeted with our next set of main characters, Stephanie and Alex, a young married couple carrying their baby to the Bay of Claridge, Maryland. They're visiting Stephanie's parents for the night to see the fireworks, and they have no idea what is going on. They arrive at the end of the film after all of these horrible events take place, and it is such a dichotomy because they're given some warnings, they'll see some weird things on the way, and it's really slow rolled and it's really built very well. And it's really obvious that their storyline was the short story that was written prior to this movie's creation. And it's done very well. I really like it. It could have been its own film, although I will say it would have been a bit weaker. I love the documentary style because it is a documentary not of found footage. It is a documentary of exposure, similar to Blackfish or The Cove, where it is uncovering a government cover-up to a tragedy that happened. And of course, this fictional city. And that adds to it, Claridge being fictional, because when the government blackouts start happening and no one is able to talk about what happened on this July 4th celebration, we feel familiar. It feels familiar because the shots are from Maryland, the shots are from North Carolina, South Carolina, and everything feels familiar, so you think it must be a real place, but I've never heard of it. And that's an element there. It adds to it, and I really like it. Well, these people are suffering in Claridge. Something is going wrong. A lot of people are sick, and in between these scenes, we learn that it's now 60 people in ER, and Dr. Jack Abrams is panicking and cannot figure out what is going on. And he says to the CDC a very telling line. He tells them that something is causing the people to be almost eaten from the outside in, as well as in another part of the body from the inside out. And he and the CDC decide that It must be bacteriological in nature or fungal in nature. Maybe two piggybacking off each other. At this point, we're greeted with the radio station, the local radio station, where conspiracy theories are flying. People are calling in, and it's very interesting because this town starts wondering if it's a government cover-up, if it's really aliens, if it's Russia, if it's a biological warfare entity brought over from another country to wipe us out. No one knows what it is. And all of these ideas are being put out there. Well, at this point, the mayor takes notice. And the mayor joins the radio talk. And he tells everyone that they should have fun, enjoy the festivities. But he urges them to be responsible and not jump in the water, as it probably has bacteria. That's when things start to escalate. You see a woman covered in blood walks down her neighborhood street, dripping blood everywhere. Her head looks like it has been beaten in, and then she falls to the ground. At this point, the news changes. Our reporter, Donna Thompson, got wind of this phone call, and she was the first on the scene. She interviewed a neighbor who witnessed what happened, and she was under the impression that it was a murder. She interviews the man, talking about how there might be a domestic violence element if this is a bad neighborhood. And she's very presumptive and aggressive in her questioning. And the man is very upset because he talks about how no one wanted this woman dead. No one knows what's happened with her. And we're all very worried. This sets off a domino effect. During this interview, Donna is watching this interview in the future, and they show footage of the local news station, sort of a behind the scenes when a commercial's running, and you see the two anchors not discussing how scary all of this is. No, they're discussing how they can't believe a college reporter took this big story from them and that she's going to mess it all up. She's not good at all at her job. And that's when you start to feel this, you get this feeling that no one is taking the problem seriously. Everyone is viewing it through a selfish lens. Everyone is, instead of seeing the greater impact this could have on the city or the state, maybe even the country, for all they know, instead they see how this impacts my day, what I want to do, my career, my political aspirations. Back at the hospital, the doctor is starting to have to take drastic measures. In fact, he is having to amputate hands and legs because the bacteria that he believes he is fighting is causing their limbs to decay. So he's having to amputate, I mean, it is left and right. He's having to just take them off, and people are getting scared. You see nurses walking out, leaving, and people are locked in a room together. At this point, we also get some insight into what is going on outside of our few main characters. You'll see shots where people cannot leave Claridge. They're trying to leave. No one can find out why the bridges were all shut down, why there was traffic, why nothing was getting out. You'll also notice in the film at this point that cell phones were not working. It's completely shut down. And it's played at first like the system's getting overwhelmed. Too many people are calling. Later on, you learn that the National Guard was called in, and they are blocking off the exits. They are shutting down the cell service. That, of course, creates a lot of panic with the town. So, the doctor is cutting open many bodies, and the CDC and EPA are trying to figure out what happened with those divers, because the divers died, and other people are starting to die. So they're trying to figure out what happened, what kind of epidemic we're looking at. And then we get our great reveal. It adds up. These breadcrumbs that have been dropped with documentary footage are all compiled together into a montage explaining what happened to Claridge, Maryland on July 4th. The monster has been lurking in the ocean this whole time. It's been right beneath their noses, naturally existing, and in fact, naturally existing in our world, is a tiny crustacean known as the isopod, one of the oldest living creatures still alive today. These tiny crustaceans are parasitic in nature. And the one that the movie uses is a real-life isopod known as, I'm going to butcher this name, Psammathoa exigua. This isopod will drop its larvae into the bodies of fish through their gills. These larvae attach to the inside of the fish and will grow to the size of the fish's tongue. They will then eat the tongue and replace that fish's tongue. That's right, these tiny bugs will replace the fish's tongue and eat the food that the fish is eating. It will eventually grow and burst out of the fish to continue the life cycle. Yes, that's right. You might be scratching your head and questioning if I'm really correct with all this. They are, in fact, very real creatures. And this little bug, normally very small and non-harmful to humans, was made large and aggressive in the film by the steroids being fed to the chickens right next to the ocean. The chicken's waste was being dumped into the ocean in such an exorbitant amount that when the isopods ate the steroids, they grew both in size and in quantity. They also grew more aggressive. And at this point, the gears are rolling and you realize that throughout the film, all of this, what appeared to be B-roll footage of families enjoying days at the beach, jumping in the water off their boat, all of these images are people dying. They have gotten in the water. Once they're in the water, the microscopic organisms are inside. And it's a ticking time bomb. And it's the similar feeling that you get when you watch HBO's show Chernobyl, where you see the explosion, you see the radioactive dust, and you're just watching the people breathe it in. You know the whole time that they're going to die. They've been sentenced already, no matter what they do. And at this point in the film, that's the feeling you get for all of these townspeople. Well, at this point throughout the film, you see the havoc increase exponentially. People start going insane from the pain of the isopods within their body, and they start reacting, of course, poorly. They'll either attack each other or attack themselves in order to get the isopods out. You'll even see in a few scenes, it still gives me shivers talking about it, the head of the isopod poking out at parts of the body. You'll see remnants in the movie of people's jaws completely blown off by the isopods and the larvae sticking their heads out. It's, oh man, I have a thing about stuff under my skin, and oh man, it just got to me. And it's not that it's this graphic CGI display or this kind of lame practical effect. No, it's just the concept alone is enough to drive me over the edge, make me uncomfortable. And then you see the tragedy that affects these people because no one is able to help and no one can help. And even worse, some are unwilling to help. And ironically, the mayor ends up dying because he's so freaked out as he drives alone late at night, seeing dead bodies of people that have been ravaged by these isopods. He gets into a car accident. Text shows up on the screen saying that the mayor's injuries were determined to have been completely able to be survived had emergency services been available. But at that point, emergency services were so overwhelmed that they could not respond. And it's his own eagerness to prove that he was a good mayor. He covered up the pollution from the chicken factory. He covered up the fact that his water treatment plant was not working. And you even learn later on that the EPA had been inspecting this plant and they found many violations, radiation, pollutants, and they state that in 2014 we'll be condemning. And that's just after that mayor's term is up. There are a lot of moments in the film where you see people making decisions flippantly that are having a major impact, and they seem very small. Everything seemed contained up until the end. Well, towards the end, Alex and Stephanie arrive, and it turns out that Alex had an isopod growing inside him on the trip over the isopod ends up causing him to get into so much incredible pain that he has to be put out of his misery by his wife, Stephanie. And this is one of the points of the film that caused a problem. It got a little schlocky. Because if you've seen any kind of body horror film before, you see it coming a mile away. And it's very fake. Because that's just how it is. So that's how their story ends. Donna and her cameraman, who have been documenting all of this, they end up getting frightened by people who are near death with the isopod. So they're frantically chasing them, wanting relief, wanting harm. Who knows? They're driven mad by the pain. Well, they run away and the footage cuts off and Donna finishes the narration. But I would like to talk about Dr. Abrams. He decided, at the end of the film, we learn that he decided to stay behind. He locked himself in the ICU because he knew he was infected. He continued to try and save anyone he could, and he eventually got to a point where he was alone in the entire hospital. The shots are eerie. The power has obviously been cut to the hospital. The emergency lights are on. There's no one around. His staff left well before he did. And he is performing an autopsy, and he finds the isopods, and he learns, and he states that he's recording this footage so that the truth can get out, that the mayor had turned his back on these little bugs that were growing just beneath his nose and intentionally ignored the problem so that people would get in the ocean, putting themselves in harm's way. Now, this film, though made in 2012, feels like reliving early 2020. It very much had that feel of a problem slowly growing and no one wanting to take it seriously, and then eventually it got way out of hand. And the concept of those who are supposed to protect us, the concept of them being just as powerless to a foreign, unknown aggressor is terrifying. And the first 3/4 of the film feels almost intimate, seeing so many people go through such accurate depictions of panic and fear. It's eerie. Now let's do the good, bad, and ugly. The good, or my favorite part of the film, was the utter realism and upsetting nature of the beginning of the film, particularly not showing the isopods and gore throughout the movie. In fact, leaving it up to your imagination made it far worse for me. Ugh, it was unpleasant. The bad side of the film, what I didn't really like, was that several scenes towards the end become rather schlocky, like many found footage movies. And unfortunately, this often indicates that the director didn't really know how to end the film. Like I'd mentioned before, a lot of the information and research he had done was for a genuine documentary. Well, when you get into fiction, you don't really know how to end. A lot of times, there's the Stephen King method where you press a button, you nuke your characters, and that's the end. And the ugly, or most disturbing, the ending of the film, the very, very ending, the last scene, shows the CDC director talking to Homeland Security. That's how high up the chain it got. Homeland Security states that they saw the bites on the divers weeks before the events of the movie, and they thought that it looked like a new species or possibly even a biological weapon. The CDC director asked why they didn't get the report, but Homeland Security says they thought they sent it. And everyone behind the CDC director hearing this rolls their eyes, shrugs, and is irritated at this kind of flippancy. And during the whole conversation, really, you see that the CDC staff is in disbelief that this tragedy almost resulted due to the carelessness of many government figures. And finally, right at the end, that cinched it up, the CDC director says that he has an entire dead town. Homeland Security responds by saying, "It's a small town. Let's not blow this out of proportion." Boy, that just sent shivers down my spine. It harkened back to the concepts briefly touched on in The Imitation Game, where they discuss how many casualties is too many. All right, we're going to take a quick break. I got to grab some coffee. We're going to hear a word from today's sponsor. And welcome back. I hope you enjoyed that ad. It was a good one. Now let's talk about the film Creep. I'm just going to give a brief summary of this, and then we'll wrap things up, get out of here with time to spare. Creep, available on Netflix for your viewing pleasure, is a fantastic introduction to the Duplass brothers. Those are the madmen behind the series Room 104 on HBO. These brothers are excellent at making any viewer feel absolutely uncomfortable and powerless. Creep is best defined as the horror of the awkward. You see, Aaron, a struggling videographer, is hired by a mysterious client for a significant amount of money, for a project undisclosed. Aaron arrives and is immediately creeped out and scared by the uncomfortably friendly Joseph, played excellently by Mark Duplass. This weird bond, it's hard to describe, forms between the two, where Joseph will increase how uncomfortable the circumstances are and manipulate and emotionally blackmail Aaron into continuing to stay. And at the end, when the film reaches its climactic moment, Joseph asks Aaron why he stayed, when it was so obvious something sinister was up. Let's go check that one out. This movie is great because it's almost funny at times. It can almost be described as a horror comedy. Sometimes Mark Duplass will just be terrifying and also hilarious. And it's a weird connection, a weird combination of feelings. Oh man, it just sets you off. It's great, but not amazing. Overall, I'd say it's just more unpleasant, upsetting, kind of off-putting. So, knock yourself out. Also, it's kind of handycam style, so I guess it fits with this episode. Now, I want to make a quick note and a little bit of a promo, a little bit of self-promotion. The next episode is going to be controversial, so, you know, a little spicy. I think you can take it, though. I think we can all handle it after this year. We're all grown-ups. But this next episode is going to deal with the issue of disturbing films and really how to make them right. You see, due to recent controversy involving a film I think we've all heard of, Cuties, on Netflix, and a lot of the horrible content of this film, I wanted to discuss how directors have handled difficult topics in the past, whether just to be indulgent in horrible content or craft a good story that handles disturbing content. I wanted to discuss just a few overall, not necessarily dig deep, because really, you can say one sentence and you've summarized most of these movies. But mainly, I want to deal with how the directors have handled it and contrast that with how the Cuties director did a terrible job of handling that content, regardless of what she thinks she wanted to make. She did a terrible job at it, and if I get riled up now, there's not going to be another episode, so I need to calm down. And of course, that episode is going to be age-restricted, but if you are either too young or you just don't want to hear about disturbing films, because I'm going to tell you right now, right off the bat, you're warned, it is going to have a lot of real awful content. So just, you're warned, okay? Don't... You know, I know, we're all adults, we know what we're doing here, okay? So you're warned. So if you don't want to hear that kind of content, I have no problem with that. I plan to have another Quick Words episode coming out around that same time, so you'll still get your fix. You'll get your In My Own Words fix, so don't worry. You'll be good to go. And that's all I have for us today. Isn't that great? That was a lot of fun. I'm glad to be back. Make sure you remember, if you liked this episode, be sure to subscribe and let your friends and family know. Be a bother. Bring it up at Thanksgiving. Do whatever you gotta do. Make sure you hashtag spread the word. And to keep up with the latest from In My Own Words and myself, you can find us on Facebook and Instagram. Hey, you can even email us at imowpodcast@gmail.com. Remember, again, to hashtag spread the word. My name's Wes Young. This has been In My Own Words, and I will see you in the next episode.